I believe that you believe
what happened to you. Let me ask you a question. You know what an obsession is?
I have a general idea.
Right. Well, define it simply in brevity is an intense interest in a particular subject. So intense that sometimes it may border on being fanatical. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. Some people do become very intense in a subject that they're interested in. Knowing what an obsession is, Calvin, you said you originally had a dream.
That's right.
All right. Your memory of your dream is phenomenal, Calvin, because a dream scientifically has been proven. We all dream, and we rarely remember the contents of the dream except for a few fleeting parts of it.
We are definitely once a dream from the bottom.
Which goes against a practicality to begin with. Now, an obsession, again, according to a scientific analysis of it, often leads to dreams. The dreams are of equal intensity, but it is possible to remember them very much and later in your waking hours for them to be real to you. Is it possible, Calvin, that your initial interest in flying saucers, and you say in your own book, and my obsession, for that is what it seems to be.
I am not characterizing you as being obsessed with flying saucers. This is a fact characterization. Is it possible, Calvin, that you have been dreaming with obsession?
I might quote
it's quite possible that I have been dreaming. And I might quote a line from a Chinese philosopher who once made the statement, "Last night I dreamed I was a butterfly. Today am I a butterfly dreaming that I am a man?"
May I quote not a Chinese philosopher, but may I quote a report from the Army Surgeon General? I don't know the exact year. It was about 2 or 3 years after the Second World War, and the report was to a particular general who was in charge of enlistment blasting torture. They had conducted tests on weapons to fight throughout the first time recent war. They found a surprisingly high percentage of the veterans that were tested, and they were all classifications. Ages, types of discharges. They found a lot of surprising percentage were dreaming with a constancy that was also surprising of being called back into the Army. Might that not have happened to you? It has happened to me and continues to, and I have been discharged from the Army for the past 13 years.
I am not denying the fact. I admitted the fact.
This was a dream, the beginning of it,
the end of this experience of making physical contact, as far as I am concerned, was very, very physical. The dream, I did dream it. I am making the initial contact with this one called Creston. On September 15th, 1952, this was a physical experience, as far as I am concerned.
Correct, Calvin, as far as you are concerned.
And you feel it should be thought,
you will pardon the vernacular, as an actual physical experience of yours by others, that they buy it?
That is entirely up to the individual. They can accept or reject it, matters not to me.
Well, it should matter to you, Calvin. It matters to me because if this were an actuality, again, you see, I am always impressed by history, by those events that will shape forthcoming events. Now, this is not an indifferent account you have had. This is certainly not a minor one. This is important to me, and important enough to you to have written a book. So I don't think you can wave off my reaction, that of anybody in this room, or anybody within your community, country, or anywhere else. I think it is important.
Should I believe that that is there, or could happen to me or to somebody else?
Well, the point that I am trying to make is this, that I do my own thinking. And when people read this book, I hope that they will do their own thinking. And if they want to deny themselves their story, as I have related it, that is very tricky. If they want to accept it, I'm very pleased. This happened to me. I am just reporting.
And you are reporting this as
accurately as I possibly can.
That I have no doubt. But you are reporting this as an ostensible, real experience.
You're not reporting it as something that has gone through your mind and you're submitting it as the real or unreal.
I'm reporting it as something very physical.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Gerson, you reported your first sighting over Pennsylvania, and you seem to emphasize the fact that there was quite a color change. How long had you been exposed to saucer stories prior to the sighting?
I don't believe there were any stories at that particular time. Most of the reports that I had read up to that particular time came in through newspaper services and magazines, periodicals, and so forth and so on.
Did you not say that prior to that sighting, you became curious because your father was interested in saucers?
Yes.
My father started the father.
I would say that almost every saucer story talks about this fantastic color change.
I think they do. I think that it adds credence to the overall picture.
Why is this change in light so indicative of a saucer in the eyes of saucer enthusiasts? Why couldn't it be a natural phenomenon in the clouds rather than the saucer?
I've never been exposed to natural phenomena as such.
Then you actually don't know whether it was a natural phenomenon because you had not been exposed to one.
Right. The newspaper the following day carried the story as it being a flying saucer. It was reported by other people in the area. I was not alone that evening. In the night, there were other people out seeing the same thing.
I might cite the fact that a news reporter once read his own obituary in a newspaper, and if he read it, he must have been very much alive. By that I mean the fact that a newspaper reports a sighting doesn't mean that it was a sighting. But I'd like to get back to something else. How long were you in the service?
A total of 8 years.
You were in the Air Corps?
Yes.
In what capacity?
I was a staff sergeant.
Flight?
No, I worked. My duties took me into food service most of the time.
Combat tank?
No, I was during the first 4 years of my military life, it was with the Army. There I was a rifleman. Or a cannoneer with an artillery battalion.
Were you on extensive maneuvers with this unit?
No.
You say that you had a vision or a dream. How much exposure to saucer stories did you have prior to the dream?
Well, up to that time, I was about 4 years, I suppose. The story broke, of course, in 1947. This happened in 1952.
Isn't there the fact that when a person is exposed to any particular thing for quite a period, that the physical protection is over and the person goes into a natural sleep, that the mind continues to function, and the thing that is most pressed into the mind or memory is the thing that comes forth in these dreams?
Well, I am not qualified to answer that. I'm not a psychologist.
I understand, though, that your statement is accepted as fact.
Well, then wouldn't you assume, according to that, if it's accepted as a fact, and you have just stated that it is, that your dream might have been a manifestation of the thought prior to that particular sleep?
It's quite possible. Isn't it also true that people awaken from dreams with dreams, believing that when they're being attacked that it's just as real as it actually happened?
I've heard of such dreams.
Then these dreams could have been just dreams.
I don't believe that, this is my opinion, of course, I don't believe that there is anybody qualified to make a qualified statement on such a phenomena, the phenomena of dreams. We don't know what they are. I do understand that a number of leading ministers, our government, are quite concerned on the subject of dreams, and they're giving it quite a bit of study and research. Perhaps a few years from now, we will be more qualified to, or I will be more qualified to answer the question.
Going back to your book, was this book listed in the catalogue in the Library of Congress?
I believe it is.
Is it listed as fiction or fact?
That I am not qualified to
answer. Was it written as fiction or fact?
It was written and presented as fact. You say that you hear the voice come through your personal radio in your car. Was there a report in the newspapers of any other vehicle or any other radio reporting the same thing?
Not to my knowledge.
How do you account for the fact that only you could hear on a given set frequency a message from someone somewhere without someone else hearing the same message?
I can't explain it because I don't understand it.
Could it have been that through fatigue in driving in your car that you could have imagined these voices?
That's quite possible.
Then if there is a possibility that it was that, then we can't accept this particular statement as fact, can we?
That depends upon the person and whose brain thinking.
Hello?
Oh, the Calvin girl and Calvin C. Gavin. I've been listening to your story, and I'm terribly sorry that we don't have the opportunity to get through all the details of your experience. I particularly like the title of your book. I believe it's taken from the poem by Baudelaire, "The night has a thousand eyes, but then the day but one," and so on. The life of the whole world dies when love is done. I suspect that was somewhat the drive behind your seeing the flying saucers. Would I be correct in saying that?
I'm not familiar with the poem.
So how did you hit down the title?
Coming back from overseas, a boy, a Navy boy, suggested the title.
Oh, I see. Well, he probably knew this film.
Probably.
What I did want to say about the book was that I think your book is, if your book is not fact, I think it is a far more important book than if it is fact, because if it is fact, it's something which is rather dull and will be accomplished, and we will know the Venetians, and the Venetians will know us. And frankly, I don't think it makes too much difference whether we know Venetians or don't know Venetians. We know people in Europe, and we know people in Africa, and we know people in Australia, and we still face the same problems in living. But if your book is not fact, then it becomes extremely important, because we are living in a world today where people are more dead than alive in the sense that they are losing their imagination. And the cultivation of imagination is one of the most important parts of living. And if your book is untrue as fact, it is a very fine thing because it is a weapon of imagination. And you're having dreams and living in worlds with all sorts of strange experiences and strange people. becomes a very important contribution to human life and enriches our experiences. You may think I'm all right in telling you something of this sort.
I think it's quite interesting.
Well, this,
well, no, it's a little humid in the room at the moment. Not all wet, just a little damp.
It's been a very long day and a long night. And we're waiting for the first launching tomorrow.
That thing takes off. History is made. Columbus and the Wright brothers are nothing at all.
It will take off.
It will take off, I hear. I see in the corner Mr. Ipswich is deeply immersed in several algebraic formulas
trying to figure out what the relativity of one of the other is. Oh, Tucky.
I'm figuring out the odds of going to give on tomorrow.
Tucky is noggin, and I think he's about to say something of great importance.
No, I just about to lay about approximately odds of 10 to 1 on tomorrow's morning. That's about the. It's really mathematical, of course. It has nothing to do with my own feelings in this, Calvin. You definitely feel that it will take off. I mean, barring
you. Definitely.
Do you see the craft, incidentally?
Not the baby.
Are you seeing the larger one or the model? The
Yes, I've seen, well, the plans. The theory is quite sound.
You applied to the theory of the accumulators and so on?
I have given quite a bit of study.
May I ask you a question? I haven't read your book thoroughly, but I've been looking through it outside.
Were there any in your discussions with the people from other planets?
I think it's from Bermuda, Venus, I'm in pretty good shape, too.
Was there any discussion of space flight?
Yes.
You mean how they...
Yeah.
How they,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there has been.
Of course, It goes into conversation that I was not familiar with at the time and still have very little understanding of it, but they talk of a multi-phase motor. And when such a motor is designed and built, that you couldn't name one that they couldn't get to within minutes.
These conversations, were they telepathic or were some of them?
They were
conversations.
I don't know if anybody asked you, but I'll ask you again. Were they in appearances similar to people on Earth?
Yes.
I mean, just including
the person next door.
Was this an adopted form or was this an irregular form?
They appeared quite relaxed, and
all I need to say was that he adopted this type of form to...
No,
they are quite human.
I see. I know there's a sort of story for Fate magazine recently and mentioned the fact that the increase in science has become very evident. During the proximity of Venus now to Earth, I don't know if you've heard anything about this, but it was reported by Major Keogh, among other people.
Well, I will make this statement that within the next four of our months of this year,
the people to the southern end of our country will see quite a number of what is called flying saucers.
Very good, Calvin. Thank you very much for being with us. This is Warren Pack winding it up at Oklahoma City, and you've been speaking to Calvin C.
Calvin, the author of the 900,000 very interesting book, and we're in Oklahoma City for the launching of the Austin
CX-1, which is supposed to go off tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. Of course, this is baby model prototype, and that's ending right now. Thank you very much, Calvin.
Sorry, according to the time that we're going on out here, it is now just a few minutes after 2. And at 3 o'clock, I understand that they will attempt to launch the OTC circular foil craft for the first time. Whether this will be a successful launching or not, well, only time will tell.
We want to interview a few of the people standing around here to get some opinion from them.
First of all, let's walk over here to this gentleman. What is your name, sir?
My name is Albert Guy.
Albert Guy. I understand, Mr. Guy, that you're a full-blooded Indian. Is that true, sir?
Yes, sir, I am.
I was wondering if you have any opinion about the possibility of people going to the moon, sir. What do you think about this?
Well,
It'd be a great thing, I guess, but I don't know too much about it.
Mr. Guy, do you think there's a possibility that there are people on the moon now?
Well, that I couldn't say, but I have my father-in-law who is 93 years old, and he's a full body man. And we were telling him about the people going to the moon. And he said, well, he said, I can't say too much about that, but he says the white people are so greedy that they've taken up all the land here now, they want some more land up around the moon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Guy. Well, there's an opinion on the part of a full-blooded American Indian
on the outskirts of Oklahoma City. Once again, the white people prove that they're greedy. They're trying to take the moon. Well, let's find out. What do you think about this, young man? Incidentally, what is your name?
Charles Mudd.
And where are you from, Charles? Bethany?
Well, that doesn't ring a bell with me. Where is Bethany?
About 15 miles west of
here. What are you doing out of Frontier City today?
Looking around.
Well, I mean, did you come out to see this spacecraft or anything?
Well, I read about it in the paper, and I just want to see what was going to happen.
Then I'd like to ask you something. I've read all of the newspapers out here for the last 24 hours, and I haven't seen a word about it. What newspaper do you read?
One of them was my parents' work.
Now, 2 weeks ago, there was a story.
Just a small column or whatever you call it.
Just a small column. What do you think about this?
I don't buy
that. Well,
I'll go along with the gentleman.
You'll go along with him. You don't buy it either. What do you think about Mr. Guy, the full-blooded American Indian, about his comment that once again the white people are greedy? They not only tried to take everything away from the Indians here, but now they're going to the moon to take it away from the moon people.
I'll go along with him on that.
You go along with everything, huh?
I'll agree with him on that.
Let me ask you this. Are you going along to the moon?
I hope not.
All right. Thank you very much, young man. Nice talking with you. May I talk with you now?
What is your name?
Donna Bryan.
And where are you from?
Oklahoma City.
And what are you doing out here today?
Well, I came out to find out more about this space machine.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about it so far?
Well, it's rather interesting. A friend of mine is telling me a series involved behind it. I don't know if they'll work or not, but it'll be interesting to see.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is really a rare opportunity for me because I've been trying to find somebody to explain to me the series. I have a lot of time. Will you tell me something about the series?
Well,
mind breaking this, please?
Oh, well, I really can't explain it except that it has some magnets in it.
Yes.
And part of it moves in one direction, and the other part moves in the other direction, and it cuts across the gravitational field.
I see.
And creates its own power somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Other than
that. That's it.
Well, something similar to that. I don't know the theory behind it.
You think they'll be successful?
Well, I really don't know. It'll be interesting to watch whether they are on.
I want to ask you this question. If they invited you to go to the moon, of course, they're not going to the moon today. They're not even attempting that. But we've been told that the designer of this craft, Otis T. Carr, incidentally, he's president of OTC Enterprises, he claims that he's going to the moon on December 7th, 1959, not in the craft that we're going to see launched this afternoon, but in the full-size craft. Would you go along if you were invited?
I think it would be interesting. I'm not sure that I'm a... out to conquer space, so it might be interesting to see what happens.
You ever thought about it?
Oh, yeah.
What do you think we would find on the moon?
Well, we're told that it's just sort of a vacant planet. It's sort of our bone on it.
Wow.
There's nothing going there. It's just craters, and I've read that it's dust. For miles and miles, and if anybody set foot on it, well, the nest would all fly up.
I understand you got dust in Oklahoma, too. Why go to the moon for more?
That's true, we didn't.
Thank you very much for talking with me. I appreciate it very much. Well, we've got some other people out here. Let's see. We've got a young man here by the name of Charles C. Carradine with Horizons Unlimited. In other words, you dig this right away, right?
Well, yes, sir. I guess you'd say so.
You're with us all the way. I mean, there's nothing mysterious about this.
No, sir.
This is going to go.
Yes, sir.
Today?
We hope today.
That wasn't my question. Let me rephrase the question again.
Is this going to, are we going to witness a successful launching today?
According to Mr. Carr, we are, and he pretty well knows what he's talking about, so I guess we are.
That's an interesting comment. Let me ask you, why do you think that Mr. Carr knows what he's talking about?
Well, it looks like this. If he thought that the thing, well, he wouldn't, he'd be sure that it was going to fly before he launched in front of a bunch of people, wouldn't he?
I don't know. I haven't got the answers. When you have a microphone in your hand, you come over and ask me. In the meantime, I'm asking and you're answering. I really don't know. I want to know from you.
Well, I'll say it's going to fly.
It's going to fly.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, Charles. Here's a gentleman by the name of William H. Murray III, Horizons Unlimited. What happened to William Murray II?
Well, he passed away about 4 years ago.
And you're the third. You're carrying on the Murrays.
Yeah, I'm trying to. What do you think about this? May I call you Bill?
Sure.
What do you think about the launching that we hope to witness today?
Well, I've heard lectures on the principles of it, you know, and from what I've heard, it ought to work.
You really think it'll work?
It's completely new, well, not completely new theory, but so far there's only one man that's got to get the cut.
Mm-hmm. And that's Carr.
That's him.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Bill Murray. Yes.
Howie, oh, I know her. Yes, I know her. I know her.
This is Mrs. Dan Fry for... eight listeners in the 27 states that we talk to, they certainly know the name of Dan Fry. Dan Fry is the man that claims he went from the White Sands Proving Grounds in New Mexico to New York and back. Gee, it's a distance of about 4,000 miles or so in about 36 minutes. We've talked to him many times. We have his very charming wife out here with us at Frontier City. I had the pleasure of meeting her back in... on May 11th and May 12th in the year of 1957, the Giant Rock Airport. That's located about 17 miles from Yucca, California. We were out there, we were the guests of Judge Van Tassel. And Mrs. Fry, what do you think about it today?
Well, from what I've heard, I feel a theory. Well, can I quote my husband?
You can quote your husband, by all means.
He says the theory is fine. It's just a matter of whether it will or will not work. And, of course, we're all hoping that it will. And we feel that eventually it will, if not even today, because of the fact that, after all, the satellites all didn't work on the first trial either.
Uh-huh. What happened to Dan? Why isn't he out here today?
He's attending another space convention, a space age convention in Las Vegas, Nevada, which is an air show, and they are... they have a booth there, the Crescent Engineering, and he's showing his instruments.
I don't mean to be unkind to the convention or the gathering that we have here today, but would you say the one that your husband is attending is more or less scientific, where this here is a little metaphysical and mystical?
Well, I don't know, because I don't know anything about the other one. I just know that they had a booth there, and he had to operate the booth.
Mm-hmm.
And it is scientific instruments that they are showing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much, Mrs. Dan Fry. Here we are again, neighbors. Frontier City, Oklahoma, on the outskirts of Oklahoma City. We reported to you this afternoon that we're out here. It's a beautiful day. We've been talking to a lot of people. We had a very, very unusual experience. We went in this OTC ride. This is actually an amusement park out here. And according to what we've been told, it's just a matter of a few minutes and something's going to happen. The launching of the OTC circular foil craft. At the present moment, I'm sitting in a souvenir shop. And at the particular table that they've been kind enough to permit me to use, I can see everything that's going on outside. I see Dennis Gwitt and Ellery Lanier. They're milling around out there with the thousands of people. There's Warren Pack. Warren Pack, again, has that little pad and pencil out. He must be trying to get some additional information. I wonder if you'd be a little quiet over there. Thank you very much. There's a little noise in the souvenir shop, people coming in and buying souvenirs, and I might add, friends, that a lot of the souvenirs were never made in Oklahoma City. In fact, they must be getting mail orders and telephone orders.
259.
Well, that means that we have exactly 60 seconds. And in 60 seconds from now, we should see something.
Now, I notice that there's a tent over to one side, that is, there's canvas that has been spread over something. I don't know whether that is some construction work going on over there or whether they have the six-foot prototype model. But I imagine in just a few seconds we'll have more information and more knowledge as to whether or not the OTT circular foil craft will get up. You know, the only problem that they have, and they're greatly concerned about it, according to the engineers out here, they're afraid that they cannot control it, because if it goes into orbit, they have all of them very, very valuable instruments that will take them another few months to manufacture again to continue the experiment. Morris, what time is it now?
3 o'clock night, John.
3 o'clock. And at the present time, nothing is happening except more and more people are gathering in front of the window of this souvenir shop. I see somebody over there. It looks like somebody is going to make a speech, an announcement of some type. Morris, do me a favor. Will you go out there and see if you can catch Pat? He's over there near the saucer. See if you can get him in a moment, because I cannot hear what's going on the outside. The position that I am in this souvenir shop, I do not know what the announcement is. It looks like Warren Pat, yes. Kaylee has just talked with Warren, and Warren is coming in now. Here he comes, good old Warren. There he is.
Yes. That's why I laughed, but he talked about fools going to the south.
Well, don't tell us. What happened there for
it? Mr. Wayne Aho just announced that there will be an unfortunate two-hour delay. Approximately 2 hours.
A two-hour delay?
Yes.
Well, they have the saucer right over there under canvas, don't they?
No, they don't. I had thought that also. But obviously the saucer did not arrive here. It is still back in that warehouse that we visited Saturday morning. Remember that? I was there Saturday about 7:30 in the morning. That building way out on the edge of town.
Well, the one where I did the interview, where we had all of that wet intrigue.
Well, obviously there's more intrigue, but it's dry, hot intrigue today because, as you know, it's about 95 out here.
I don't know the exact reason. There's a little bit vague on the reason also, but I know that Major Aho is going to spend the next several hours entertaining the people here by giving a little lecture on various forms of flying saucers and several of the other people give some discussions. But it looks like now around 5 to 5:30.
Well, maybe there's no use tying this up, this booth over here. These people that own this souvenir shop have been very, very kind to me. They've permitted me to use this excellent view, and what can I say? I can only tell you this, that nothing has happened. And maybe it will happen about 5 o'clock. So, neighbors, stick with me. I'll be back with you in a couple of hours.
Well, I was going to say back again. We are back again on the air. And I know by the time you listen to this, this coming Wednesday night, technically Thursday morning, this particular segment we're doing now, I hope, has been spliced to another segment when Warren Pack got out of the car to find out what's been happening and what the announcement is about. Warren is back in the car with me. Again, let me say it's marvelous to sit out here in this hot Oklahoma sun in an air-conditioned station wagon. Warren, what's happened?
Oh, I hate to spoil your enjoyment, John, but I just found out that there will be no launching today, definitely. This is been assured by, there was an announcement, they asked all the newspaper men to come up to the marshal's office in Frontier City. You know, I have an old-time western town here. And out came this gentleman, I can't recall his name, who represents the Frontier City Association. And he said that there would be a press conference in this abandoned building, or formerly abandoned building.
Well, is that the building that we went to the first night we came into town?
Yes, the same place where we saw the saucer, the small saucer, in three parts, and it's still there, obviously. It's going to stay there for some time.
Well, all right. I'll tell you what. I'll ask Dave to get all the equipment together, the recorders and all.
No, John, no. They've asked that we just have the newspapermen in there. In fact, they're not asking any outsiders in there. I mean, it's nothing personal. Make a strictly a press conference out of this with a few photographers. I know Sam will be in there, Sam Vandenberg. And I will bring out what they say, but they're not going to do it live. Obviously, they're very upset about the whole matter. And it'll be a direct to me. They don't want anything, obviously, permanent. They don't know where they stand, and they just want to make it an informal press conference.
Are you trying to tell me, Warren, that I can't walk in there with a tape recorder and record this press conference?
Well, pardon me, a press con?
Actually, at press conferences, they do not like... it's a general practice, John. It's not an idea down here. At press conferences, they do not use tape recorders. It just happens to be a general practice at most press conferences.
I won't argue with you, Warren. This is your business. You've been in it for years as a reporter.
Look, the only thing I can say is you take one of the other cars that we have at our disposal here. Can you take Ellery and Ben?
Yeah, Ellery and Ben will go with me, and we'll probably meet you back at the motel, and we'll give you a quick report on what happened.
Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's running around here. You notice, you look outside the window, you see the thing. Place in front of the ride is now almost vacant.
Sure,
anybody's dreaming. And I know our only concern is this other night. They said how big smiles on that face is, and if they knew this was going to happen. I haven't seen Major Aho. I guess they're going over to the building.
I'm making a speech, Temple.
Possibly. I think that there were a few words that he didn't say between 3 and 5 o'clock.
If there are, man, I don't know where he hid them. Neighbors.
Warren is going to go over to the abandoned warehouse, the one that we had some difficulty, that I had some difficulty gaining entrance to the first morning that we arrived in Oklahoma City. And there's no use, at least I don't see any reason for me to sit out here, although it's rather comfortable. And I think I'll drive back to Oklahoma City. That's about 67 miles from where I'm parked in this station wagon. And I'll grab a shower and get a little eat and call today. The fellas sitting in the back seat are kidding about my driving. Fellas, don't talk about my driving. Warren is already getting into the other car, and so maybe we'll be back shortly as far as radio time is concerned, and it may be a space of 2 or 3 hours as far as recording time is concerned. So stick with us. This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, 710 on the dial. Seated around a card table that I have in my room at the motel are three well-known members of the Long John Group, Ben Esquish, Ellery Lanier, and Warren Pack. Now, they've just come back from the abandoned warehouse where the saucer was, and I'm going to speak with Warren first. Warren, I'm going to be honest with you. I am burning. I think I was turned out or something. I'm not attempting to show what my thoughts I are profession as a journalist. I know that Ellery Lanier is a journalist, but certainly Ben Esquith is not a journalist. If they wouldn't permit me to go in there with a tape recorder, why didn't somebody suggest for me to go in without a tape recorder?
I want to know what actually happened. I don't mean to imply that you won't give me an accurate report. But how is it that Ben could get in and I couldn't?
Well, I don't know, John. Really, the whole thing was so confused. First of all, nobody connected with OTC Enterprises had anything to do with the announcement back at Frontier City. This was handled entirely by the commissioner for the Frontier City Association. I don't know anything that you could hear. I hadn't seen Norman Colton for some hours. Major Aho, of course, was around talking, but then when they had this big announcement, he disappeared also. We just over to the, what we call the abandoned warehouse, of course, it's in the back of another house, and it's not really abandoned anymore, and I found about a dozen photographers there, and about 3 or 4 newspapermen, although here, they seem to double up, John. I don't know if you noticed that the newspapermen seem to be taking pictures also, which is the sign of the small town newspaper, although this is a pretty large newspaper, you know, from Oklahoma. And there were some television people there.
And this fair was not run in any special way. No one was in charge. I finally found Norm out in the back, and he sort of shrugged his shoulders about what had happened. He said he didn't know the whole story. And I finally pieced it together from about five different people there, including some of the people who interviewed the other night. And the story, as they tell me, and I cannot comment on it, because I have no comment on it, is that the bearing mount on the top of the saucer all of a sudden was 1/16 of an inch off. Once in a while, he was getting in the corner, he saw his name, but he was giving very sort of pep talk to the workers, and it took all confusion. The place is full of flashing balls. I think Ellery was really more in the middle of it until it was done. I was out in the outskirts with Norman, and they could say what happened.
Ben, I won't ask any questions. There's a microphone. Please hook up.
Well, I don't remember, John. I wasn't allowed to go into the warehouse or laboratory or construction shed on that mysterious moonlight morning trip that we made. And this was the first time I saw the saucer. And the first thing I noticed when I walked in there was that the original members of the construction crew or the mechanics were not in the building at all. In fact, when we got back to the motel later, I recognized that the operations chief was here and had obviously been here for some time, and there were a completely different group of people. The saucer had the top taken off, and the cabin compartment was off to one side, and there was a various amount of tools laying around, and the saucer was right in the middle. And photographers were clicking away, and a few of them had movie cameras. And something very funny happened that, you know, that it was really a very peculiar thing, is that Al Lachman stooped down to look at the underside of the craft, and he immediately was told to get up, please stand up, sir, by a little charcoal-suited disciple of Major Wayne S. Aho. And I recognize this because the man had an identification badge from Washington Saucer Intelligence. And he was told to get up, and then a photographer who had a movie camera started to photograph the bottom of the ship also, and this little disciple approached him, and there ensued an argument about he couldn't do this and he would have to surrender the film. And I think the man with the movie camera gave him certain directions about where he could go, and it wasn't to the moon. Now, I went back beyond the other people so that I could look at the bottom of the saucer craft, and all I could see was the underside, which was mounted on, seemed to be some very ordinary a series of three dolly rails. Also, there was nothing quite mysterious about it at all. Also, on top of the saucer, there was a pasted over portion. And this is quite serious. This is no gag on my part. I asked what was underneath it, and they said that they had glued the bearings back in, and the glue hadn't dried yet, and I forsook the opportunity of asking if the glue had come apart. But there's one thing that I noticed. Every single model that has been in our studio,
yes,
or that we have seen, the Utron accumulator was tilted towards the center of the ship. But the Utron accumulator on this ship is tilted towards the outside. It seems to bear on an opinion I expressed to Warren earlier that there never was a set of engineering drawings for this thing. It seems to have been, you know, go as go can. Mm-hmm.
And let me just for a moment. I'm a little hot here again.
I don't blame you.
And I'm very burned about this. You just tossed in another name. Now, after all, I'm not against Lachman. This is not anti-Lachmanly.
But where does Lachman come in on this, too?
I am the guy that made the whole thing possible to go down there, and the one person that they refused to permit in the abandoned warehouse is Long John.
Why is this? What is this, Tom?
What? Wait a minute. What do you want? I was going to say, John, that you know that you had a little difficulty getting in there last night, and several people, one of the former military men who were connected with OTC Enterprises, are very hesitant about recordings and so on. You've been asking about a poor family thing like that. I just want to say that you might have had your small microphone in your lapel, possibly. And, of course, you know that he's very worried about secrecy and all these kinds of things. And he's worried
Ben said about the looking underneath the bed, or was it the cupboard, or looking underneath the saucer. I forget which it was. But, of course, you've got to realize the military mind, John, is a very wondrous place of their own, and perhaps a little strange at times. And over secrecy is the sign of the military mind, always. Secrecy, and more secrecy.
Well, all right, but
anyway, John, I have some information that might have something to bear on this, and this is not a routine, but somebody in the crowd who was behind me, who I've never seen before, who I didn't see the night that we went out there, and he was wearing some kind of army shirt and pants, and it looked like he may have been one of the workmen, although I've never seen him there before.
I was commenting to somebody about, I caught your name, and I sort of half turned to listen.
Remember, Lon John being the most dangerous man in sorcerdom,
because he exposes these people and has an earring of 5.5 pounds and doesn't treat them fairly, or something like that. I have not seen that person since. I've not seen him back in the motel. It was the first time I saw him, and I can't remember. I can remember his face, but I haven't heard his name or seen it before now.
You don't have to remember one individual face, Ben. When you go out to any of the conventions, you'll be able to pick up maybe 400 or 500 faces if they have that many people. Of people who believe that Lon John is detrimental to sausagedom. Because they don't buy a lot of things, a lot of people think that I'm being unfair. I think I've been more than fair, and I think anybody on the program will agree, and I think many listeners. We listen to the story, but we just don't buy these things. We want to see more. Now, we've spent a couple of days out here, and the craft is not launched. Now, I've talked to some people, too, and I sort of changed my mind. Last night, I thought maybe something would happen. Now, I don't know. According to what I hear, they may try to launch it tomorrow. Now, whether we'll be around at that time, I don't know. Ellery, did you want to add something?
Yes, sir. You know, this was a very interesting second visit to this strange shack hidden behind me, the abandoned corrugated iron factory on the outskirts of Oklahoma City. And my second visit, I would say, was an amusing visit. The first visit was a very profound experience. And on the second visit, one of the technicians present, a man, well, I won't mention his name, told me that the trouble was that the lid wouldn't fit. And immediately I looked at this device, and it looked like a great big pot, a big cooking pot, and somehow you had to get the cover on this pot before you started the meal going, and you couldn't get the lid, and the thing might explode. The parts might fly apart, and the whole trouble was that there was a 16th of an inch that had to be shaved off. And then, besides that, there was a very interesting and romantic note. Along the neutronic regenerating devices, the technicians who had worked on this device with Herculean energy through nights and days for the appointed hour, these gentlemen had each in turn for the historic moment inscribed their names in black crayon around the disc. And there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 names which I hesitate to mention at the moment, but it was a real romantic and touching event. And then I spoke very seriously to one of these men, and he assured me that previous models had taken off and been lost in outer space. If this was so, then when the lid is fitted on, there's a tight fit, the thing can spin, it should take off. But that remains to be seen. I also got an accurate count on the weight. There were various reports that the baby saucer, as it is called, that was about to be born, would weigh 600 pounds, and then someone said, no, 200, and another said 300. And the final report I got was 650 pounds, which is excellent for a newborn baby.
Let me just interrupt now, Ellery. Of course, we're working under a handicap here. We're working with a small hand microphone. Do me a favor. When you're holding this microphone, don't move it around and move your hand on it too much, because it creates a lot of strange noises, and we don't want anybody to think the strange noises are from the launching of the OTC circular foil craft. Could you complete your thought?
Well, Mr. Barr, I did want to mention that the neutron regenerators were a very brilliant red color, which made the machine rather garish. But that is a note for historical records, I should say.
I thought that was a note for our artistic listeners.
Do you want to add something?
Yes, Pete Ballin, is that the way you pronounce his name? He's the chief operating engineer there. He said, very heartbroken tones, we can't sacrifice 35 years for 1/16 of an inch, which is his indication of what the whole trouble was.
I'd just like to mention one more gentleman
who said it. Mr. M. Norwood Jones of the Space Form Engineering Department of OCC Enterprises. I asked him what space form engineering was, and he said it's like sales engineering. In other words, engineering sales is sales engineering. Space form engineering is engineering space form. And he developed it in form. And he says he interprets Mr. Carr's ideas in three-dimensional illustrations.
So I said to him, are you an engineer? And he said, no, sir.
And he said, I said, are you a draftsman?
And he said, no, sir. I was going to ask him what kind of cigarettes he smoked then, but then I realized he might be a thinking man and he wanted to start in trouble.
This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, Long John with the party line. And, you know, we're not even going to be able to do everything this morning. We have a couple of other things to do. Tomorrow night, too. We have maybe around 2.5 or 3 hours of additional tapes to be used tomorrow night. So, although we still have more now that we're going to do, one thing in particular is what happened Monday morning. This is a very, very exciting bit.
In case you joined us, actually, we didn't take a coffee break this morning at all. But in case you joined us during the past hour or so, I'd like to remind you that in the Hearst Headline Service, Warren Pratt had an excellent article about what happened out in Oklahoma City and in Frontier City. And there's some other stories that will be breaking in the near future in Faith Magazine. Also, a national magazine assigned our friend Ellery Lanier to do a story. We have over 1,000 photographs that were made out at Frontier City in Oklahoma City, which will be seen in many of your national magazines during the next couple of months about our safari to Oklahoma City. And, no, I'm telling you, we're going to bring you right up to date on all of these things because, without a doubt, we had a tremendous amount of pleasure out there, and the craft is absolutely fantastic. Now, there are many rumors as to the height that it reached when eventually it was tested, when it was launched. I am not saying it was launched. You listen, and we'll get all of the details. Now, there was a young lady. There was a lady out there. I'm certainly not going to say anything about her age. I really don't know her at all, except that in my room at the motel, and it was a very, very large room, had two full-size beds in it, on Sunday night, or I might say, I guess by now it's about 1 o'clock Monday morning, there were about 5 or 6 people on both beds. And altogether in the room, I would say there were about 35 people standing, sitting on the floor, and what have you.
There was one lady that made some comment about my method of interviewing. Now, I will admit that this lady certainly has a right to her opinion. She had never met me until I went out to Oklahoma City, but she said she knew a lot about me. And she was under the impression that I was extremely rough with all people that believed in flying saucers. And she told this to me off the air, and I said, look, I have a microphone here. I'll let you tell your story.
I don't know if you do it for everybody, but I mean, both the end of tonight and last night, I think this car brings oldest car. And I think that what he's trying to do is with God. And I think it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
regardless of what all you fellows here think. And that's my belief, and I don't like who our world's going to be. Turn down, turn apart, and stretched on the rack, and turn upside down, and tossed and twisted and turned. It hurts me inside, because I have faith in this man. And I'll something wrong for us. Just like it said on his tape tonight, that your photographer over there heard the tape. And I think when your photographer came in there, he was very skeptical. But I watched him all evening. And I saw him wandering around all over the room, looking at all these so-called crazy flying saucer people. And when your photographer left that room, he came out of there a different man.
Are you talking about our photographer,
yes.
Sam Vandiver?
Yes.
Charlotte.
I think he was really convinced tonight.
Charlotte, may I have it?
Some of these crazy flying saucer people aren't as crazy as he thought they were to begin with.
Charlotte, you've embarrassed me.
I
for this reason. No, you haven't. We're on the air, though, and I'm going to go through with it.
Well, I'm just showing what I believe.
Fine. Charlotte, this is understandable. Did you see us arrive here when we got off the plane? Now, just a moment. Charlotte, please, let me complete this thought.
Sorry.
Charlotte, did you notice the two gentlemen with the white jackets that got off the plane, too? They came with a photographer.
No, I was so interested in seeing whether you were going to be frightened or whether you were going to take it in stride that I didn't see anybody else.
Let me just say this to you, Charlotte. Sam Vandiver is one of the nicest guys around. That's why he's with us.
I don't agree with Sam.
You don't?
Sam buys a lot of these things. All I know is that Sam is one of the pedophiles, a real friend of mine, and he buys a lot of this nonsense. I don't. But let's get back to Carr.
Well, wait a minute. Well, in California, it's common knowledge if you don't buy anything.
Do they mention my name?
Oh, yes. All the people in California.
That's what I wanted to do.
We can't hear you all the time, but we know what you're doing.
Right.
And we all talk about Long John. He never buys anything.
Right. Now, Charlotte, let me just make this point. I think you're being extremely unfair this morning when you say that we've been clobbering cars. We haven't. I mean, we don't, let us say that at the present moment, we have not seen the craft launch.
Neither have I.
Oh, fine.
But I don't believe in it.
Well, this is your right. This is your right. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm not sitting here and saying, Charlotte, you shouldn't agree or believe. But do you know that members, the executives of OTC Enterprises, have been on my show in New York, I would say at least 8 times, and if I'm correct, in estimating 8 times, that means that they've been on the air for over 40 hours. Do you know that the average interview is done in a period of 30 minutes? Can you stop to figure this out a moment, Charlotte? That 40 hours, basing it on half-hour shows, would mean that they have been on 80 times on WOR. How many times have they been with Ben Hunter in L.A.?
Well, I'll answer that like this.
No, answer it. Just tell me.
If these people from Otis Cars Enterprise have been on your show for 80 hours talking about this...
80 half hours.
80 half hours and 40 hours talking about this wonderful project, and they haven't convinced any of you guys yet of its worth, well, then all I can say is that the world has really gone to the dogs.
Or would you say that possibly we're just non-believers?
That's possible.
How many hours has Otis T. Carr been on the Ben Hunter show in L.A.?
Well, I never heard him on the Ben Hunter show, I didn't meet him on the Ben Hunter show.
Was he on the Ben Hunter show?
I belonged to the Understanding Group, and he came as a lecturer in my group in San Fernando Valley.
Was he on the Ben Hunter show?
And I only had to meet him that one time and talk to that man, and I felt his sincerity, his honesty, and I believe that what he was doing...
Was he on the Ben Hunter show?
Yes, he was, but I didn't hear
How
him.
How long?
I didn't hear him that night.
But you know he was on.
I think he was on.
Charlotte, thank you very, very much, and happy sausage.
Don't think that I'm mad at you. Only I know a lot
of... You like me?
Yeah, I think you're a swell guy.
Thank you very much.
Only I don't like the way you pick everybody to pieces, because some of these people who come in here and want to talk to you, a lot of these things that they want to tell you are very sacred to them.
All right, fine.
And it's just like you'd take somebody that's an innocent person and put them out in the middle of the desert and put him down on a cross and let the vulture stand over him, waiting for him to get half dead.
Charlotte, thank you very much. Nice talking with you.
Good
night.
I'm sorry.
We're going over to the table now. I see that Warren Pack has located Norman Colton of OTC Enterprises. At this time in the morning, I can't even say OTC. Norman Colton has been with Otis Carr for a number of years, and unfortunately, we can't go over to Mercy Hospital in Oklahoma City to interview Otis T. Carr. And so we've been hunting, frankly, for hours now. And eventually we located Norman Colton at the place where they've been working on the saucer. And Warren Pack brought him into the room now, and we'll find out from Norman we'll get a report from Norman about what happened yesterday. Of course, yesterday was Sunday. The 19th day of April, the year of 1959. We were told during an interview that we made with Otis T. Carr at Mercy Hospital on Saturday afternoon that, the 19th day of April was a very important day. It was the anniversary of the ride of Paul Revere. And that sort of concluded my interview with Otis T. Carr. He left himself wide open for me to come back with a remark. And I said to Otis, do you think that possibly somebody else is being taken for a ride? And he sort of laughed. And we left the room, his room at Percy Hospital. Now, Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock, that was yesterday, just about 12 hours ago. I guess it's just about 3 o'clock now. Monday morning in Oklahoma City. And nothing happened. Of course, there was an opportunity for the press to go over to see the saucer, but it wasn't launched according to schedule. So let's find out from Norman Colton what happened. Norman, it's all yours.
Well, first, John, I'd like to say to the people within range of WOR's party line that the only thing we're really disheartened and dispirited about is the fact that so many people came such great distances and had to go away without being able to see what they came to see and what we sincerely hoped and expected they would. The actual mechanical difficulty that made it impossible to launch the craft today as scheduled was a very minor thing. It took only a few minutes to correct of itself, but because the craft had to be disassembled or partially disassembled and reassembled in order to get the one part out that needed a few thousandths machined off of it, the time we had remaining of the afternoon to get the craft from the shop over to Frontier City and then out to the launching test area was just all consumed. We knew it would be dark, and so we had to decide at that point not to keep people in suspense any longer, let them know the real facts. And so, as you said, we had the announcement made at Frontier City that the launching would not go off as scheduled this afternoon, but we invited the members of the press who were on hand waiting to come over to the machine shop and see for themselves that it was only a minor difficulty that could be quickly corrected, and sometime today, that is Monday the 20th, we expect to continue with the program reschedule the flight test and invite the members of the press to come back again, those who were able to stay over, and see a successful launching of the 6-foot diameter OTCX-1.
Norman, I don't know. I've got dozens of questions, but I think it would be rather interesting at this time. I know that you've had a kind of a rough day, and I know that all of the directors of OTC Enterprises Incorporated of Baltimore, Maryland are certainly not particularly happy about this delay. Supposing we wait until tomorrow and just hope, and if we can stay and around late enough, maybe we'll be able to witness the launching. And if not, we wish you good luck.
Sure, thank you, and I hope you can stay, because I repeat, the only thing we're unhappy or uncomfortable about is that we've disappointed so many people. We will hope that they'll be watching their TV screens and listening to WOR when the first announcement is made that we have been able to validate Mr. Carr's principles.
Thank you very much, Norman Coleman. WOR Radio, your station in New York, long down with the party line. Now, let me just make a brief comment. We're live again at this point. I am, at this moment, just slightly confused because the next portion of the tape, I don't know whether I describe in detail what took place after we completed the interview with Norman Coleman. I guess it's about 3:30 or so, and I said goodnight to everybody. And Charlene Sturgis, the young lady whose husband, David Sturgis, passed away about a year and a half ago, the well-known astrologer, and she was there, too. And she, in turn, left with the group. And I don't know if she had some ability of precognition or something like that, but she said to me, John, I wonder if they're going to do something to launch that saucer about 5 or 6 in the morning. Well,
I thought that,
you know, maybe the late hour was detrimental to her mental health for a moment.
And I said to her, I don't know, Mrs. Sturgis, you
go back to with Margaret Storm and get a good night's sleep, and we'll see you in the morning. Well, after everybody left and I bid some of the people that were with me good night, I went back in my room and decided to take a shower and possibly get to bed. And I took the shower and I decided to take just a little walk around the grounds for around 15 or 20 minutes. And I slipped on a pair of chinos and a shirt and the jacket. And believe me, it was cold after getting out of the shower. And I walked around and I saw somebody down at the end of the, or rather in the front of the motel. Of course, I had a beautiful office there, coffee all night long, free too, I might add. Ice if you need it, not for your coffee, but for something else that you may have handy around. And I saw somebody walking around near the swimming pool. And it turned out to be Sam Vandenberg. And I said, Sam, what are you doing up? By now it's about 4 in the morning. Well, he said, John, something's going to happen about 5 or 5:30 in the morning. I said, what do you mean it's going to happen? I said, I'm on the inside of all of this. And he said, John, it's going to happen. Well, I said, who else knows about it? Well, he said, naturally, Colton knows. And he says, Lanier. He said, Lanier knows. I said, where's Lanier? He said, he's in Colton's room. So I walked over and rapped on the door, and there's Lanier. He is seated in Colton's room. Colton is sound asleep. I think you could have put a bomb under him and nothing would have happened. But Lanier is in there typing a story. And I said to Ellery, what are you up for? He said, I'm writing a story. I said, don't con me, Ellery. Something must be going on because you're not going to write a story all night long when you could be getting some sleep and you need it.
Well, he said, I'm wide awake, and I thought I might as well do it now. I said, well, why do you do it in Colton's room? Why don't you go to your own room and write your story? To make a long story short, after I pestered him a little bit, I found out that he had an idea that something would happen at 5 o'clock. Now, how Charlene Sturgis and Ellery Lanier and Sam Vandivert had the same idea at the same time, I don't know, but I have a hunch. Nevertheless, I decided to stay up. And I must admit that I only had about 5 or 6 hours sleep during the entire 3 or 4 days that we were in Oklahoma City. I went down to the office of the motel, got a couple of containers of coffee, that is in these glass, what do they call them, carafes or carafes or carafes, I think, something like that. Nevertheless, I brought them back to my room, and Sam had a sliced chicken sandwich and a piece of Danish, and he brought that in, and Ellery came in, and we decided to eat that, and about 5 minutes, Sam jumped up, grabbed my phone, called room number 31. Colton, evidently, we couldn't get him up with just the ringing of a telephone bell, and so we went over, pardon me, knocked at the door. No one answered. We got a pass key from the manager of the motel, the night manager. We went in. We tried to get Colton up. Eventually, we did. We went over to Mrs. Sturgis' room. We awakened her, and we got our friend Warren Pack, sports writer for the New York Journal American, up, and we left the rest of them sleeping. That is Al Lottman and Dave Field and Ben Isquith, and so there was Ellery Lanier, Sam Vandivert, Mrs. Sturgis, Walter McGraw, Warren Pack, and Long John. It is now 5 o'clock in the morning. Oh, maybe, and it's just 5 o'clock now, too. At the stories I'm relating, it happened at 5 o'clock. Bitter cold. And we decided to drive out to the abandoned warehouse, and from there, go out to the launching pad. Well, I'm not going to say any more. Let's hear what went on the following morning as I recorded it on tape.
Hi, neighbors. This is Long John with the party once again. With the party line, in fact. If I sound exhausted, I am. We haven't been to bed. Actually, well, I guess since we've been out here, we've had maybe 4 or 5 hours sleep. We interviewed Norman Colton of OTC Enterprises, and no doubt you've just heard that, because according to my plans, what we're taping right now will follow the Norman Colton interview. We arrived out at the abandoned warehouse about 5:15 this morning. And although it was a beautiful sunny day yesterday afternoon, this morning it is cold. 5 of us came out in one car, and we were told that there would be at least 3 or 4 people out here to take the craft outside to attempt to levitate it at least a few inches off the ground prior to taking it out to the launching pad. Well, friends, I can only tell you this, that it is now 9 o'clock, and they have just opened the doors. We are now in the building itself, where they still have the OTC circular foil craft disassembled. I understand within another hour and a half or 2 hours, they're going to put the third section on and then put the dome on it. Now, what's going to happen? I do not know. I can only tell you this, that we're physically exhausted. We're watching. We're waiting. Warren Pack is here. He hasn't had any sleep. And, Warren, I wondered if you wanted to comment on this at all.
Well, we seem to be getting closer to whatever is going to happen right now. A few minutes ago, the crew reported, and they were rather tired, too. In fact, I think one of them said it was the first night he'd been home in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I think that in a little while they're going to try to put it together again. I noticed on one corner one of the gentlemen is oiling the bearing that gave so much trouble yesterday, but there's one other problem right now, the extreme cold. Yesterday, as you remember, the temperature was well up in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, with the heat, you have an expansion of all parts. Now, today, I would say the temperature isn't over 40 degrees outside, and with a cold wind, and they were worried about raising the heat level in this rather drafty, corrugated barn, I might call it. And they were worried about the possible contraction of the parts, and then another problem that we ran into yesterday, except it'll be the reverse. In other words, they have honed down this bearing, which is now over in the tail, you see.
Mm-hmm.
He's working on that now. Lubricant into it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this could possibly be off again because of the cold. Mm-hmm. They're trying to heat up the place. You have an electric heater there. They have a gas heater outside. And, of course, people are starting to crowd around. I think by word of mouth, this news is getting out here. The rest of the boys showed up, as you noticed. Al Ottman and Ben, and Morris and Dave.
At least they got a little sleep, though.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And after all looking around a little bit anxiously, Ellery has been talking to the engineers, and of course now they're getting close to what they hope is launching time. They're giving out a little bit more information than they gave before.
Right.
In fact, they even permitted us to look underneath the saucer.
I think I'll walk over here with the equipment and see if we can listen into the conversation that Ellery is having with the engineer. Toss out that first one there.
All right.
Eugene, C-A-R-I-N-I, Carini.
Now, the basic principle, now we know that when we have these circles of magnets rotating, you have a spiral field of magnetism going around in a donut shape, which intersects the gravitational field of the Earth, and that will develop the lift.
Correct, that's right. In other words, what we do is act with the field of the Earth, and all we have to do is change the polarity at any given point, and as you know, we'll get the variation that we're looking for in either direction.
Mm-hmm. And this very fabulous thing that you have, I think, for the first time really described publicly about the magnetic field. The first time that it has been announced publicly, the magnetic field developed by these field coils intersects the double cone coil on the rotatable inner disk, generating an electric current within this double cone, which is then transmitted by circuitry into the neutron, where in turn it is again transmitted to the circle of field coils, generating again, and this creates this donut of magnetic fields going around the spirals, intersecting the Earth's magnetic field, and away we go.
Could you give me the price of two of them? I could use both of them.
I tell you, he's got it perfect.
He really has. He's done a good... that was the voice of Ellery Lanier interviewing a couple of the engineers here, and I know that Ellery has some additional questions to ask, and we'll sort of step to one side and walk around here and see if we can get an opinion from some of the other fellas. Again, I repeat, no sleep, but we may be here watching history in the process of being made. I doubt it, but we're listening. Al Lottman, opinion?
Still waiting to see anything other than an uncovered bit of Rube Goldberg-type invention.
That's your opinion?
Exactly.
I think they have something that has a great chance of going.
It's been a big change, John, in there in the past, roughly 5-6 hours while I was sleeping.
I'll agree with you. Been a change in the weather. Ben Isquith.
It's incapable for me to think before 10 o'clock in the morning. Therefore, I couldn't possibly form an opinion any different than one I had yesterday.
Mm-hmm. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Well, I don't know, neighbors. We're walking around. It's mighty cold in here. And I think that's about all we can say at this moment. We'll be back with you in a couple of minutes when we have a little more information. This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, 710 on the dial. And this is Long John with the party line.
Yeah, and we've got something, too. Oh, boy. A lot of disappointment. A lot of fun. And we went back to the motel, made some more tapes, which we just won't have time tonight to use. I'm going to use them tomorrow night with a group of engineers. We had a symposium out there. And some other things. Incidentally, Dave Field, don't forget that Russ Dunham. We want to take that, the aircraft engineer and all. So, you know what I think we should do? Let you hear what we have on the tape now. This is sort of the wrap-up as far as Oklahoma City Airport was concerned at that time. Can we hear that now, please?
Well, I guess this wraps it up for another 3 or 4 days. We're going to be leaving Oklahoma City in about 40 minutes. And, of course, the OTC circular foil craft did not get off the ground. We received a call from Norman Colton over at our motel just a couple of minutes before we took the cars back to the airport. And according to Norman, we may get a call at the airport here before we leave for New York again. So, neighbors, I can say that we've enjoyed it out here. And, well, when we get on the plane, I'll get a report from some of the fellas. We'll get their opinions. Well, neighbors, this just about wraps up the trip. We're on flight 208 en route to New York from Oklahoma City. And we left two of the boys back in Oklahoma City, Sam Vandevert, the photographer, and Ellery Landier. At this point, I don't know what Ellery's doing out there, but I don't think the craft will ever get up. Or at least, when we left, nothing happened. I've got with me Dave Field and Bennett with the cybernetician. And, of course, Sergeant Morris Paley from the Perth Amboy Police Department, Al Lottman, and Warren Pack from the New York Journal-American. Warren, supposing you tell us, well, you must have some opinion about what happened.
Well, I must say I was disappointed only in that the finish was not as fine a production as I would expect from Norman Colton and some of his associates. I didn't expect that this thing, meaning the six-foot prototype, would ever get off the ground, at least not under the neutron accumulators. I think that the people in Oklahoma City were very nice. I'm talking about the natives now. Everywhere we went, they were very warmly received. And we met some very nice people. This young astrologist, Zip, she was a very lovely girl. And a lot of other people. But all in all, it was a nice trip both ways. I mean, a little bit rough, possibly. We didn't learn anything we didn't know before. Actually, the plastic 18-inch model works a lot better than the aluminum 6-foot craft. And that's about it. I don't know what else you can say. It's nice to get back to New York again. And the best thing about it, as I said, was a very friendly reception we got from the people in Oklahoma.
Well, Warren, that's your opinion. I don't have too, you know, much to say about it. I think Al Lottman may want to say a word or two. Al?
Contrary to you, Warren, I'm not in the least bit disappointed. In a sense, I expected nothing.
I had not even a feeling, an absolute conviction that it never would work, that if it did work, it would be to such a minute extent that it would prove nothing. And not that I'm happy about it. I am never pleased with a failure of anybody. I would have liked to have been surprised, but I cannot pretend disappointment. So from a strictly personal viewpoint, I've had a great time because our own companionship, we've had a million laughs, not at the expense of anybody else, with ourselves. And although some of the people who are associated with the Enterprise may feel very badly, I don't, because I think they were living in a false paradise. It's contrary to anything in physical laws. They attempted to use some form of mystical thinking in order to attain their objective, and they should realize that that is just not going to occur. As for our own group, Warren, as you will certainly confirm, we have had a wonderful time, and for that, I'm certainly grateful to everyone who received us so cordially. John?
Well, neighbors,
I imagine that you hear the roar of the motors. And that means that we're taking off from Washington, D.C. We had some fantastic idea, or at least we heard some people out there that had some fantastic ideas that our government would be very, very interested in the OTC circular foil craft. Well, I don't know. At this point, I don't think anybody is interested in anything. But who knows? Maybe by the time we get this on the air, maybe they'll be in business. Maybe the craft will work. I just want to take a look down the line here. Sergeant Morris Paley is behind me. Sergeant, you want to take it?
Yes, John. Mine is a feeling of mixed emotion. Coming out, intending to see something, we were filled with exhilaration and more or less over-jubilant. And now on the way back, as we start taxiing down the runway for our last leg home, I don't know whether it's a feeling of regret that we have left after having such a wonderful time running this thing down, or a feeling of disappointment in that we did not see the craft go up. However, I feel that the boys that are still there watching the progress of what's going to take place will keep us fully informed as to what is going to happen, and until such time, a slight expectation will run high. But nostalgia sort of rules deep, and I'm sort of swelling a bit, so I'm going to turn the mic over to Ben Isquith for further comment.
Well, Morris, I somewhat disagree with you. I have no expectations, and I had no expectations when I went out there except to have a terrific time, which we did with these crazy friends of ours that we call the Long John Panel. I never laughed so much in 3 days of my life. But what happened was exactly what I expected to happen. In fact, it was nothing. Also, right now, on the last leg of the trip from Washington to New York, in spite of all the fun we had and how nice the people in Oklahoma are, I feel a great sense of goodness coming over me and getting home. Home to New York, New York cooking, and New York sanity.
Well, I've got the mic back again. This is Long John with the Party Line. And we're over Washington, D.C. At this moment, there's another plane. Looks like it's going right in front of us. No, crossed under us. So, neighbors, we've got, I think, about 50 or 60 minutes before we'll get back to Manhattan. I think I'll try to catch up and get a little shut-eye. And, well, we'll be back most likely live when this tape is used over the facilities of WOR.